have the observable universe. We're able to see a finite volume of some larger universe. We don't know how much larger the global universe is, but we have a finite sample of volume, and we see a finite range of scales, number of galaxies, and other for every observable confined to this finite volume. So the question is basically a statistics question. Is our Hubble volume a representative or a biased sample? And so the statistics, the perturbations in our volume that are giving rise to the observed structure are characterized by statistical distributions. So are those distributions representative of the larger volume, or are they systematically biased in some way? So how limited is our access to the global statistics? So schematically, we're in the observable universe, and there may be fluctuations on larger scales. Are those fluctuations biasing us in some way? So here's sort of another picture of the same idea. So if observable modes, so the sort of green patch here represents the observable universe, or some subvolume of a larger volume. We can just think in that general context. If fluctuations within the observable subvolume are correlated to longer wavelength modes, which would be locally unobservable to an observer in that subvolume, then there can be a biasing of the statistics observed in any subvolume. So that's shown here. Basically, the statistics of, and this zeta here, which I'll talk about more in a moment, zeta is the fluctuations in the early universe which generate the structure that we observe. So I'll be asking this question at the level of the initial conditions that generate the observed structure. So the way we can describe the statistical properties of these initial conditions are with endpoint functions, which carry information about the properties of the field and any underlying physics before that generated those statistics. So basically, if the global average, the average of these endpoint functions in the larger universe, in this large volume L, is different from the same quantity averaged in a subvolume, then we have a bias. And this bias can come about because of these long wavelength background modes. So any given subvolume is just sitting on a single roll of the dice of the background modes. There's just a single realization of longer wavelength modes at the site of any subvolume. So if those modes are correlated, then we have a potential bias. So this scale L here, we can think of as being just some larger scale, and it doesn't have to be the entire universe. It can just be, for example, the largest scale. We have statistics in that larger volume being perturbative, so just small fluctuations on a homogeneous background. So really, this is all just a statistics problem.
So my question, if you observe this larger volume, then why does it matter?
If
you don't observe it, I mean, you said you have a local observable volume.
Yeah. So I mean, if the larger volume, for example, is the volume coming out of inflation, and we want to know what's the underlying physics giving rise to that inflating volume, then we could be limited in how much we can know about those statistics. So I mean, if we're only interested in like the initial conditions for the last 60 E folds of inflation for our volume, then we wouldn't care. But if we're interested in the theory describing inflation and further back in a larger volume, then we may care.
So you're saying like if we measure our two-point function, or we can interpret that as some
Non-Gaussian or something. Yeah. So. What? Say it again.
Say we measure something as a non-Gaussianity, it could be just our bias,
to be a degeneracy. Yeah. So that's basically where I'm going is if we measure non-Gaussianity, is that representative of statistics in the larger volume? And it's non-Gaussianity that could couple these modes and introduce such a bias. Okay. So outline of the talk here. I will just give some background and set up in terms of the initial conditions and how to describe random fields statistically. And then look at this subsampling with local type non-Gaussianity, which is the simplest phenomenological kind, which couples modes at very different scales. And look at what happens when you have a large volume with weak non-Gaussianity, weak mode coupling, and then very strong non-Gaussianity. And then secondly, I'll look at scale dependence. What happens, can there be a biasing of scale dependent parameters like the spectral index of the power spectrum? And then if I have time, look at what happens when for more general kinds of mode coupling beyond local non-Gaussianity.
These would be like something relevant only if one of these endpoint functions is significant to measure, right? If they are all significant,
the more tightly we can constrain non-Gaussianity to be close to zero, the more limited this scenario in which we would be biased is. And I'll show like exactly what sort of a benchmark you could aim for in terms of constraining non-Gaussianity in terms of placing limits on how biased we could be. Okay, so basic setup here is during inflation, we have quantum fluctuations in the metric and any matter fields during inflation, such as the inflaton. And these quantum fluctuations are translated into classical perturbations in the metric, or gravitational waves, or just perturbations in the energy density in the very early universe. And these are small perturbations on a homogeneous background. And we expect from the CMB that they're 1 part in 10 to the 5th. But nonlinear evolution and gravitational instability evolve these perturbations into non-perturbative structures, which we can characterize with number density of dark matter halos or galaxies. And so the goal is we want to extract primordial information from this data of large-scale structure or CMB. And so we think we at least largely understand the intermediate physics. So if possible, we want to extract information about the initial conditions set by inflation in order to answer questions such as, is inflation right? Or what is the particle physics of inflation? What is the physics of the early universe? So again, we are limited to a finite range of scales. The diagram on the bottom left here is showing scales exiting the horizon, the scale of causal contact during inflation, and then at a later epoch, re-entering into causal contact. And we see a finite range of scales. So there's a above the Hubble scale, we can't observe any modes. And below that, we run into difficulties with nonlinear evolution, although we hope that we can learn more there. But that's basically put some restrictions on the problem. So just another point for context. Recently, we have measurements from the Planck satellite of FNL local being very small. So FNL local is how much non-Gaussianity that there is for local type non-Gaussianity, which I'll introduce in a moment. And so non-Gaussianity is consistent with zero and at most like 1 part in 10 to the 4th. So very Gaussian perturbations, and the primordial power spectrum has a slightly red tilt, so slightly more power on larger than shorter scales. This 0.96 is a deviation from 1 from scale invariance. And so these are two of the statistics interested in asking, could these be biased in comparison to what they would be as averaged in a larger volume? Okay. So again, we'll be asking this question at the level of the initial conditions. So the statistics of the primordial curvature perturbation, zeta, carry information about inflation or some previous physics we expect. And so zeta is fluctuations in the amount of expansion, fluctuations in the metric. So first of all, we're just going to assume that at some fixed spatial slice in the early universe, we'll specify statistics of the curvature perturbation and just ask what happens from there. We won't ask what physics generated those initial conditions. We're just interested in the statistical properties that, of those initial conditions. Although one can obviously ask. what physics would generate that kind of the statistics that we'll be looking at. But again, we have the large volume, L, and some subvolume, say the observable universe. And so if you're an observer in a subvolume, the longer wavelength modes will be part of what you perceive to be the local background. And so the average of the scale factor in any given subvolume will include those longer wavelength modes. So if we split the perturbations up into a collection of long wavelength Fourier modes and short wavelength Fourier modes, if we just split up the Fourier integral, then the observed fluctuations in the subvolume will basically be the short scale fluctuations, but they'll be rescaled by this 1 plus zeta long factor, basically because the background is being rescaled, and so the fluctuations are around a slightly different background. But that's not so important for the rest of the talk, because that's just changing the overall amplitude. And so we're more interested in the statistics like non-Gaussianity. Okay. So yeah, just a little background about non-Gaussianity. So in the simplest case, gives Gaussian fluctuations, and in this case, the modes at any given Fourier scale are just drawn separately from a Gaussian distribution. So they're not drawn in a way that correlates them at all. So the statistics of the perturbations are completely described by the power spectrum, and there's no more information. There's no correlation between modes at this scale and another scale. So the two-point function is expressed here in terms of amount of power at a given scale. So if we go beyond that, then correlations between modes at different scales, which are captured by endpoint functions between products of more powers, higher order endpoint functions for the modes. And so the simplest case is we have a three-point correlation or bispectrum. And these are two examples, different shapes for the bispectrum. So the bispectrum is characterized by a triangle Fourier space, because this delta function here is basically saying that modes are correlated when they form a triangle. And so usually the mode coupling is described by what configuration of modes is this bispectrum largest for. And so there's two most common, the equilateral shape. The equilateral shape is when modes of similar wavelength are correlated, the local shape when modes of very different wavelength, so a squeezed triangle in momentum space, are correlated. And these are sort of showing those shapes as a function of the momenta. So another consequence of non-Gaussianity is that it can increase or decrease the amount of large-scale structure. So for example, we'll see in a moment with local-type non-Gaussianity, you introduce this mode coupling by adding a small perturbation, which is like the square of a Gaussian field. And that distribution in real space has a tail which is highly skewed, and so you end up with a larger fraction of volume where the primordial density perturbations are above some threshold for forming structure, and so this non-Gaussianity can affect how much structure you end up with. So we want to use of non-Gaussianity to distinguish between different models for physics in the early universe, which generate these different kinds of shapes. But as I mentioned a moment ago, non-Gaussianity can introduce a new kind of uncertainty, which I'll call a superhorizon cosmic variance uncertainty. And so let me describe that right now. So cosmic variance basically, statistically, let's say there's some quantity x, and it's drawn from a distribution, and that distribution has a global mean expectation value of x. And if you have a sample, a finite sample, from which you're trying to estimate that property, the variance of your sample can vary around the global mean, and that variance goes like 1 over the number of objects in your sample. And so an example of this in cosmology is the CMB. So at large scales, we don't have a lot of Fourier modes or spherical harmonic modes from which to sample the fluctuations. So we have a poor sample, low n, so there can be a larger variation around the mean from of the distribution from which these modes are drawn, and that's shown by this larger error bars and this green patch from the theoretical expectations in the CMB angular power spectrum plot. So the kind of cosmic variance that I am talking about here from superhorizon modes is basically, since we are at a particular location in the larger volume, any modes larger than we can see, we just have a single realization of those modes. So n equals one sample for these superhorizon modes. And if the modes we can observe are correlated to that very poor sample, which may not be representative of the mean in the larger universe, then this can systematically bias what we observe. And so an example of this, which I'll talk about next, is the global three-point function can affect the observed two-point function. So again, the three-point function is characterized by this triangle in momentum space. And if one of the modes, the Fourier modes, is longer than the observable universe, or the subvolume that we're interested in, so we have a very squeezed triangle, then that would just be measured in the subvolume as contributing to the observed two-point function. And that.
Is this one is this like the squeeze limit of the three-point function?
You mean like the consistency relation?
Yeah.
So, and for the single field consistency relation, that would basically go to zero, and then you wouldn't have this biasing effect at all.
So, okay, so maybe that gets to what I was. I think I'm understanding the answer to the earlier question better. Are all of these in the single field case? Are these biases reinterpretable as unphysical miscalibration between the co-moving wave number and the physical wave number?
Like,
matching the co-moving wave number with the physical number using A, but because of this large. Long wavelength zeta. If you just instead of treating A as A times e to the zeta, you just renormalize that as A. That whole thing is atoidal, and then
right.
You do the mapping between physical and co-moving wave number.
I think in single field inflation, that's the only effect, and as you said, the squeeze limit vanishes, and so this you won't have a squeeze limit to give you this bias.
Okay, so
and
you're thinking this is a kind of a thing that can happen in
that's basically the Gaussianity that I'll be focusing on here is something that you would get from multi-field inflation. And so I'll come back to that later, this consistency relation.
No, I don't think so. So if I have multiple fields, then it wouldn't be just the scale factor, it would be other fields as well. But they would look to us as a homogeneous background. So I think as far as physical observables are concerned, they would be just a recalibration of what appears to us as a background.
Right.
But I mean, I think your point is correct that if somebody like Brad tells us this is the initial condition of the universe, we would need to basically go through the system to connect Godsport to what we see.
Yeah.
And
even though.
I see. If you couple this with a theory of initial conditions.
Exactly. If there is a theory of initial conditions that tells us in that greater multiverse, I guess. I use that word very purposely.
Yeah.
what is the probability distribution in the multiverse? Then you need to go through this analysis to look at the local observables. But I mean, I guess it also comes with all the problems that multiverse comes with. In particular, I think there's a measure problem here because all these averages could be defined in different ways. You could weight them with physical volume or co-moving volume. Different ways of making them put to different answers.
Yeah, I think you can sort of think of it as like a small like statistical kind of measure problem.
If there were another theory, and say I said there was a stream kind of balance that produced something, I would still have the same short. Would I have any problem? I should be able to. I should do this analysis in that case without these lessons.
Any theory that has a statistic makes a statistical prediction for the whole universe.
Yeah.
Then you have to basically go through something like this to find the statistics in your local patch. So that is my step. Right.
So I don't have it
again. No, I guess all I'm saying is that I think any theory of that sort has kind of conceptual problems, because defining the statistics is an infinite universe is.
Let's do this over lunch, but yeah. I'd like to be clear that I don't want to be realized.
Okay. By the way, is there a clock that I can see, like, so I don't just, go for
11:30.
It's 11:30. Okay.
Only biological ones.
Okay.
You look at our faces.
Okay. I'll look at your faces. When you're all asleep on the floor, then I'll know. Okay. What was that?
I'll tell you when it's quarter to.
Okay. Thanks. So the first case that I'll look at here is local type non-Gaussianity, in which, this is something that you would get from multiple fields and not from a single field during inflation. So we can express the curvature perturbations as some function of a Gaussian field at each point in space. And in the case where the statistics are close to Gaussian, then we have a dominant linear term plus suppressed nonlinear terms in this Gaussian field. We just Taylor expand. And so FNL is parameterizing how large this non-Gaussianity is for the leading correction there. So to see the effect of long wavelength modes on short wavelength modes, we can again just split up the Fourier modes into a long wavelength and short wavelength piece, and this scale M is the scale of the subvolume we're interested in. So the first part of that integral there is just we'll treat as just a constant background for the subvolume. And so then the perturbations that you would measure in a subvolume, if you're observing from there, you would characterize as having a series appropriate to your observations with some amplitude of fluctuations and nonlinear parameters. And those quantities would be shifted the background, this zeta g long integral piece. And so the local statistics are then going to be modulated by the local background. So the power spectrum that you observe is going to be shifted away from the global average by this combination of FNL times the long wavelength piece, which is basically an estimate of how non-Gaussian the larger volume is. Schematically, a long wavelength perturbation, which you don't observe, is modulating the power on shorter scales. So on an over density, you'd have more power or less on an under density. So this zeta g long quantity that's controlling this bias is controlled by, one, the size of the global universe. So the variance for this background is just an integral over all of the superhorizon long wavelength scales. And so in a larger universe, you're going to, on average, have larger background fluctuations. Secondly, the power in superhorizon modes. And so in the scale invariant case, this is just proportional. The variance from which your background is drawn is just proportional to log of the range of superhorizon scales. But it's different if you have like a constant but non-scale invariant spectral index. And then thirdly, the rarity of the background. So the background is just, this zeta g long is just a Gaussian variable drawn from a Gaussian distribution, and so different subvolumes will have different levels of rarity for the background. So this plot is just plus or minus the typical root mean square amplitude of the background fluctuation, and these curves are for just different scale dependences for the superhorizon mode. So you can see that for different scale dependence, the power is the bias is different, and then as you go out to a larger range of superhorizon scales, it increases. And so here, this is put in terms of E folds if we're thinking in terms of inflation generating these superhorizon scales, but we don't need to think in terms of inflation. These are probability distributions for global quantities, assuming that you measure, say, the power spectrum or FNL to have some fixed value in your subvolume. And so the degree to which this is varying around the global average is just controlled by FNL and the range of superhorizon scales, as we saw, this N. And so this is just a log plot here. So these are just Gaussian PDFs with different variances around that that global mean. So statistics can vary significantly among subvolumes, even with globally small fluctuations, weak non-Gaussianity, so weak non-Gaussianity being basically FNL times the typical background amplitude is small, and this kind of number of E-folds, if you have enough power for superhorizon scales. This is just sort of another example that if you only have like a Gaussian field plus a cubic term, then that will regenerate a quadratic term in your subvolume when you do this long short wavelength split. And so you wouldn't expect to observe no FNL, but then to observe a four-point function, GNL, you'd expect if you're smaller than the global volume that you're going to regenerate a quadratic term, basically. I'll come back to that in a second. So the second case is, suppose we have a larger universe where the statistics are strongly non-Gaussian. So for example, zeta is a power of a Gaussian field. In this case, if you look at small enough subvolumes, the strongly non-Gaussian field can appear to be nearly Gaussian. So basically, we just, again, split zeta into the long and short wavelength collection, and then we expand this power, and so we get a linear term in the short scale fluctuations, a quadratic term, and so on. And the parameter that's controlling this series is the local background, the long wavelength fluctuations. And so if you have, basically, if your background is large compared to the root mean square for the short scale fluctuations, then for typical subvolumes, this is going to be a weakly non-Gaussian series, and the linear term is going to dominate. And so in the simplest scale invariant case, this basically is saying if you have a larger range of superhorizon scales than you have subhorizon scales in your subvolume, so K max is just like the shortest scale in this statistical problem in the subvolume, then typical subvolumes are going to be Gaussian. So you have this trend towards a sort of naturalness of Gaussianity for local type non-Gaussianity. One point though is that there's a minimum level of non-Gaussianity in the subvolumes. So again, the parameter that's controlling this series, the trend is background. And so as long as we are interested in a larger volume where the perturbations in that larger volume are still small perturbations on a homogeneous background, then basically FNL is in typical subvolumes is going to be bigger than one, because one can just show by defining the observed FNL as the amplitude of this nonlinear term in your subvolume, that is goes like one over the background. And so an observed non-Gaussianity observed inhomogeneity is what happens as you approach a non-perturbative background, as your zeta long becomes close to order one. So what this means is that we can, at least probabilistically, constrain superhorizon cosmic variance, the possibility of this bias, by tightening bounds on the observed FNL. So if we can constrain FNL observed to be order one or smaller, then if we're in a typical subvolume, this scenario becomes more unlikely.
So what is zeta GL and zeta L?
What's the difference? Yeah, sorry. So zeta L is the average of the total field zeta. So zeta L is basically like zeta GL to the P. So it's just like the amplitude of the entire non-Gaussian field, not just the Gaussian piece, which since this is strongly non-Gaussian, that's not quite the same.
So you're saying that typically you get FNL of what order one? Is that the statement?
If your larger volume has just perturbative statistics. So zeta L is still much less than one, still just a perturbation on a homogeneous background. Then in your subvolumes, the observed FNL is still going to be much larger than one. It may be small, so that what you observe is close to Gaussian, but that's as small as it can get in typical subvolumes.
But I guess there is no physical reason to force it to be much less than one. As if it could be arbitrary to be.
Yeah, I guess it's just kind of like a benchmark if you're interested in, like observationally, if we're able to. So right now, from Planck, FNL is like order 5 or smaller. If we're able to constrain it with large scale structure to be smaller, then that's just sort of an interesting benchmark for this scenario.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
I'm realizing I'm still confused on this point. If I could try to channel Niaish again here. So, in the normal situation, you're given some Lagrangian, and you, for a fixed homogeneous evolution, you start the perturbations in the Bunch Davies vacuum, and you predict at the end of the day, after that homogeneous evolution runs its course, scale factor and the various scale fields, you predict some statistics for all the perturbations. And so now you say, okay, so suppose there's a big three-point function, and there's a very long wavelength mode that has a big amplitude in my local region of space, and so the big three-point function will. Let's say it's a three-point function in the curvature perturbation. Three-point function in the curvature perturbation. So a big long wavelength theta will look like a bias. Will look like my local two-point function for zeta is biased relative to the initial homogeneous evolution I chose. Mm-hmm. So I think Niaish's statement or intuition or statement about his intuition is that. Although that my local statistics will look biased relative to that fiducial zero point homogeneous evolution I chose, that if I absorb all the long wavelength perturbations, much longer than my local Hubble horizon, into the homogeneous evolution, so I take that large zeta and reinterpret it as really a shift in the scale factor locally and so forth. Mm-hmm. That if I take that renormalized homogeneous evolution to be the real homogeneous evolution, that my local statistics will be unbiased relative to that, what I would have predicted from that homogeneous evolution. Is that correct?
Exactly.
I'm wondering whether they're at the level of just talking about endpoint functions and so forth, and not necessarily what microphysical model they came from.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit hard to see, but I wonder, is there an example where... Is there an example where you can actually see from a physical model that the local statistics are biased with respect to the appropriately renormalized, rescaled dynamics locally?
Yeah, so I think the curvaton model is an example of that. I'm not like terribly familiar with that, but I think that's a scenario where you have long wavelength fluctuations in the curvaton field, and that is something that affects the statistics in different regions. But I'm not sure in that case how to say more than that. But I think I'm not sure if this would help or connect with the question. But I think like in since these kind of statistics come from a multi-field case, I think this would sort of correspond to your observed statistics being biased, corresponding to sort of your trajectory in the say two field space during inflation. In that case your field is rolling down the potential, and it in different regions it can like diffuse away from the classical trajectory. And so then like if there's a long prehistory of that in that field space before the last 60 e-folds in our region, then I guess in our the trajectory in field space for our packs, the last 60 e-folds, if that was just what you cared about, then you wouldn't have this problem. But I guess it's a question maybe of like, are you interested in whether that trajectory in field space was preceded by some fluctuating away from a classical trajectory, if that makes sense.
Maybe I have the wrong feature, but even in the single field case, the idea of this superisomplasm variance was that you have mode coupling. You're not in the vacuum, Bunch Davis vacuum, and you're in some state where you have mode coupling between the short and the
other. Yeah, I think in single field inflation, yeah, you'd have to be like not in the Bunch Davis vacuum or something more complicated to give you that.
But mode I think coupling. Then that answers the question about this, whether you can just absorb it in a redefinition, because you're not in Bunch Davis at all. And you're in some non-trivial state where you have a non-zero in the initial state itself. You have a non-zero three-point function which couples the long and short wave modes, and that creates a non-trivial bias that you can't just.
You're saying that's the vacuum of the interacting theory, or it's you're saying you're not in the vacuum.
You're not in the vacuum. You're in a state which is not Bunch Davis. But couples long and short wave length modes together.
But I mean, this is not the calculation of an inflationary model. This is just the statistical step from the bottom about zetas.
No, but that's the assumption going into the superisomplasm variance in the.
Well, but I don't see how that. I mean, you're just talking about a particular time. We're not talking about evolution at all here. So
yeah, but the state itself has a non-trivial mode cut.
Not right. Sure, sure. But okay, you're saying it's not Bunch Davis. But I mean, obviously, today it's not going to be Bunch Davis. Bunch Davis is not about initial condition.
Right, but that's the thing, the implicit assumption. In the single field model, to do what you want to do, you have to not be in Bunch Davis at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In the initial state.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So you're saying I just shouldn't think of it as non-Gauss candidates generated dynamically. In that case, it would be observable.
Right,
is what you're saying, but you could alternatively just have some intrinsic three-point function in the initial conditions.
Right.
That's the point.
I mean, that maybe I'm wrong, but that was my estimate.
Yeah, I think. That yeah, if you were to just calculate the three-point function for zeta from a non-Bunch Davis state, and then just turn that into a statistical problem like this, and just generate a random field which gave you that bispectrum, then yeah, that would be very similar to this, and you'd have
but
the one.
But the point there is that if there is in the actual state of non-zero mode coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can't just reabsorb. You can't just take into account this biasing by reabsorbing it into the local scale factor. It's more complex. It's more non-trivial than that. So that's an example that doesn't fit.
But it seems to me that then you shouldn't be talking about classical probabilities. You should talk about wave functions. But here we're talking about classical probabilities, which is So I made that.
But even classically, you can have a mode coupling.
Sure. Right. No, but I guess my point is that would be the right language to do it at the level of the wave function. If you're talking about changing their state.
Can I also just ask while we're on? I apologize for this.
No, it's fine.
Yeah. But does anyone? So this statement that I articulated and attributed to Nyack, is it actually true? I mean, somehow it intuitively seems like it could be true. Is it clear that it is true? Do you think you can show that it is true? The one that I did, if you started Bunch Davis, the thing that I said attributed to Nyack.
Yeah, I think if you saw Bunch Davis, what you're saying is true, right? Yeah. But that's why I'm trying to give an example where it's not true.
Okay, even that, I'm not exactly sure how you would show it.
But I think you want something more than is intended. So you want to talk about evolutionary history and say that evolutionary history is the same. If you have a super horizon mode or a uniform background. But I think here we're just talking about the particular one snapshot, which is today.
Right.
And I think that's more obvious because we're not talking about evolution or anything. We just say that there's a lot of wavelength mode, and that we see so it looks like a constant to us. So it's not a dynamical statement, it's just a kinematic statement.
I guess.
Like in the Namwangs-Davies case, then you have an even stronger squeeze limit than the local non-Gaussianity, and then the background modes that you're most sensitive to, you're like more sensitive to farther infrared background modes, and
that's right. So I think it seems to need to be
non-local,
not the local.
Yeah.
All right. We should really let you get.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Nice. Okay. So the plot on the right here, sorry, the left, is a plot of numerical realizations. So just starting with a larger volume and then randomly sampling a Gaussian field in different subvolumes of that larger volume. And each point here is a point for a particular subvolume of that numerical realization. We're subsampling a zeta Gaussian squared field here. So on the y-axis we have the skewness, basically dimensionless number quantifying how non-Gaussian each of these subsamples are, and then on the x-axis the rarity of the background for that subsample. And so there's just a trend as you go out in increasing rarity, number of standard deviations for the subsample, a slight falling off of, on average, how non-Gaussian those subsamples are. So the plot on the right is from the analytical expressions on the previous slide, and this is just showing that on the x-axis, as you increase the range of your superhorizon scales, and you look at a typical subvolume with a typical background fluctuation, that the value of FNL that you would observe in that subvolume is just decreasing, and this is for different powers of a Gaussian field. But sort of the same idea. So this is just showing the expressions from the previous slide. So this is the parameter space for single source scale invariant non-Gaussianity, where it's just a Gaussian term plus a quadratic term. And I think I'll just try to go through more quickly, but basically we have on the x-axis the typical amplitude of background fluctuations, and then on the y-axis FNL and the larger volume. And basically this section here is where typical subvolumes would have observed FNL that's like order 10 or larger, which is constrained by the Planck observations. And And so that parameter space would be constrained. Out here is the non-perturbative regime, where the typical fluctuations are order one or larger. So, and then this is where typical fluctuations of this nonlinear term are order one or larger. And basically, if the point here is just graphically showing the point that I mentioned a moment ago, that if you were to require that typical subvolumes have FNL order one or smaller instead of 10 as picked here, then this blue region would come out, and then you'd basically like eliminate this parameter space where things are strongly non-Gaussian. So this above this dotted line is strongly non-Gaussian, where the non-linear term is larger in throughout the larger volume. So you can sort of ask, is if we are hoping that our observed volume is not biased compared to the larger universe, is it a good thing that we did not detect a local FNL? I guess that's a question you might ask. So I'll just mention this really briefly and then go on. You can sort of think of this biasing as like a running of your coupling constants, FNL and GNL, and the constants in your series, which are coupling different modes, a running of these with the scale of the subvolume. So if you imagine you're in a large volume and you're zooming in, looking at smaller and smaller subvolumes at some particular location X, then the parameters, the coefficients that would be describing statistics in that subvolume, are going to run with the size of the subvolume that you're looking at. And as we saw, it's a sort of running towards weak non-Gaussianity, where FNL is small and so on. I'm just going to skip these other points to try to go through it more quickly. So yeah, the second part of the talk now is scale-dependent non-Gaussianity. And this is just similar to what I've been describing. If we add a scale dependence in FNL, and so this is basically saying that different scales have a different degree of coupling to longer scales, then this can introduce a bias to the observed spectral index, the observed scale dependence for the power spectrum in any subvolume. So these quantities defined here are just weakly scale dependent functions. So there's just a weak scale dependence in the mode coupling in FNL. And then I've also introduced a second source here. So this phi g is just another Gaussian source which is contributing to the fluctuations, but it's not coupled to the other part. And that might have a slightly different running than sigma, which is characterized by this other function. So as I mentioned before, this correction to the power spectrum is coming from configurations of the bispectrum in the larger volume, where one of the modes is too long to be observed. And since we have this new scale dependence in FNL in the bispectrum, that's going to affect the scale dependence in the observed power spectrum, which is just what this expression is showing here. So sort of we can think of this as being, since a long wavelength mode due to this coupling with FNL is modulating the power, a scale dependence in FNL, so for example, NF greater than zero, meaning that FNL is increasing on small scales, that's going to mean that in different patches, the short scale modes are going to be rescaled in their amplitude differently. So for example, if you're on an overdensity, then if NF is greater than zero, that the short scale modes, which are more sensitive, are going to be amplified more. Whereas if you're on an underdensity, the short scaled modes again are going to be suppressed more. So basically the scale dependence in FNL translates into different scale dependences of the fluctuations in any smaller volume. And so explicitly, this is a shift to the spectral index power spectrum in any subvolume, which is what this expression is showing. So we want to ask, how large can this be? Again, if we look at the parameter space, can this be, can you get a shift to the spectral index that's of order the deviation of the observed power in our subvolume from scale invariance, which is like 0.04. That's what this plot is showing here. So this is similar to the plot that I showed a moment ago. First of all, at the top here, we're basically looking at a scenario where the linear term is, so the linear term is scale invariant on the left-hand side, but then the nonlinear term is growing on short scales. So then it's similar here, except for the only thing on the right-hand side is that we're changing we're giving the linear term more power on large scales. But in each case, since we're causing the nonlinear term to grow on small scales, we're damping off the power of the nonlinear term on superhorizon scales. And basically that removes the constraint that the global fluctuations be perturbative. So before we had this constraint in this region of parameter space coming from requiring that the nonlinear term be a small fluctuation in the larger volume around a homogeneous background. But now if we damp off the power in that term with a running in FNL, then we have a more of a parameter space here. And the more important point here is that you're going to get this shift in the observed scale dependence of the observed power spectrum, basically if the two sources, the linear and nonlinear term, are sourcing your fluctuations, if the power in those are sort of shifted around. And so the effect of the long wavelength background is basically going to shift around the power of your nonlinear term with respect to your linear term in any given subvolume. And so basically, you can have that shift in the scale dependence if those two pieces are of roughly similar power for a range of scales in the larger volume. They have roughly similar power. So that's sort of what this is showing here, is that there's just like a region of parameter space where delta NS can be of order 0.04. This sort of region of parameter space is where the two pieces have similar power on an observed range of scales. So at least statistically, we can arrange a scenario where we get a shift to the observed spectral index. And again, to get that, I'm not going to go through this in detail, but the conclusion is that an observed red tilt of NS less than 1 can be consistent with a globally flat or blue tilt. And on the other side, if you start with a theory for a larger volume in which you have a red tilt for the fluctuations, then you look at various subvolumes, the tilt in various subvolumes is not necessarily going to be red. It could vary if there's a mode coupling. So I'm going to skip the rest of this. It's similar ways of describing the same point. So let me just think about what I should do with the remaining time. So the point on this slide and the next is a shift to the observed bispectrum. I think I'll just say briefly here why a shift to the observed bispectrum would be potentially interesting. So although we haven't observed any non-Gaussianity, one way that a three-point function can affect observation is in large-scale structure. And so if we consider the number density of dark matter halos that has some global mean in the observable universe, and then there will be fluctuations around that mean. And so the number density in any region is going to depend on the underlying matter field. And so if we expand this field in the quantities that it depends on, it will depend on delta, the underlying matter field. So if there's an overdensity in delta, that will increase your number density of halos that will result in that region. It can also depend on zeta, the primordial curvature perturbations. And the reason for that is that if you have non-Gaussianity, you have a coupling between long and short scales in the primordial curvature perturbations. And as we saw, that on an overdensity in zeta, that will amplify your short scale fluctuations. And we know that the curvature perturbations are linked to the density perturbations with the Poisson equation. And so basically, what that means is that FNL, non-zero mode coupling, is also going to affect the dependence of the dark matter number density, and consequently the dark matter halo power spectrum. And the point here at the bottom is that if we consider, so this was just for a constant FNL, a simple FNL, if we consider the two source ansatz that I introduced a couple slides ago, we get some new scale dependence in the bispectrum. And this scale dependence is basically coming from the fact that if we have two sources and there's only mode coupling in one of those sources, then you're not going to be sensitive, the statistics in any region are not going to be sensitive to the total background in zeta. They're only going to be sensitive to the one piece, the source where that mode coupling is coming from. And so if there's a difference in scale dependence between sigma, the sector which is introducing this mode coupling, and phi, the other source, if those have different scale dependences, that difference of scale dependence is going to enter into the bispectrum. And consequently, it's also going to enter into the dark matter halo number density. So this k squared from the Poisson equation might have. I mentioned that because if we go back to the question of how superhighzen modes could be affecting what we observe, if you do the same thing of splitting the perturbations into the long and short wavelength pieces, and then you calculate what the observed bispectrum would be in any subvolume in the same way that we did for the power spectrum, you get some new scale dependence coming from the background modes. And basically, that new scale dependence can break the relationship between the bispectrum and the power spectrum. And so let me explain what I mean by that. In the single source case, the short scale fluctuations are completely correlated to the long wavelength background. So if you consider the dependence of the bispectrum in the squeezed limit, if you look at the bispectral index, which is encoding how your mode coupling depends on the long wavelength mode in the squeezed limit, then in the case where you just have a single source, this NFM is going to vanish because you only have one source, and so again, you're completely correlated to the background. And so basically, in the single source case, the scale dependence of your bispectrum on the long wavelength mode is just the same as the power spectrum. But what this calculation here shows is that even if you only have one source which is giving you your fluctuations, the long wavelength modes can give you a scale dependence in the observed bispectrum, which is characteristic of two sources. So we have this new scale dependence entering in here. And if we look at the squeezed limit, where say K1 is the long wavelength mode, then even in the single source case, we can have a shift to the squeeze limit of the bispectrum coming from a scale dependence from just a single source. So that was kind of a long-winded explanation. But the basic idea is, in the same way that we had the global three-point function affecting the observed power spectrum, the global four-point function can affect the scale dependence of the observed three-point function if, again, one of the momenta in that global four-point function is too small to be resolved. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, that might be interesting because the three-point function can affect large-scale structure and scale dependence that you would observe there. So, yep.
I forgot to tell you when there were 15 minutes left. It was back when we were eating up all your time.
Oh, okay.
So I would say maybe.
Okay. Yep, sounds good. Getting close to being done. So, we looked at the scale invariant local ansatz. We looked at adding scale dependence and looked at the bias to observed quantities in each of those cases. And so the last part here is if you consider non-local mode coupling, which is more general. So now we're saying that the fluctuations are, for example, a Gaussian piece plus a non-linear term where in momentum space, we have additional scale dependence in the nonlinear term. So the case of local non-Gaussianity is where this f function is just a constant, fnl, and then zeta is just a function of a Gaussian field at each point. But basically, if we give this ansatz more scale dependence in k-space, then we can adjust this f kernel to give us any bispectrum that we might desire. So basically, we're interested in the coupling between long and short wavelength modes, which is captured by the squeeze limit of the bispectrum, where we have one long wavelength and two short wavelength modes. So the first step that we're taking here is just considering, suppose you have some additional power law dependence in the bispectrum on long and short wavelength modes. And you can introduce this by introducing a non-local ansatz like this and adjusting the scale dependence in your quadratic term. So in that case, just following the same procedure, the observed power spectrum is again going to get corrections from the bispectrum. This ANL is just like the amplitude of this F term. And adding this scale dependence on the long and short wavelength modes in the squeeze limit is going to give you a new scale dependence in your observed power spectrum. And then the long wavelength dependence in your bispectrum is going to translate into different sensitivity to different long wavelength modes. So a weighted biasing of your super horizon modes that are entering into this shift to the observed power spectrum. So the case of local non-Gaussianity is where this correction just vanishes. The case of weaker coupling to long and short wavelength modes is where this integral is damped to more infrared modes. And then a stronger long to short coupling is going to weight the farther infrared modes more. So that's just what happens when you add scale dependence like this. And so as we were talking about earlier, one case of interest is equilateral non-Gaussianity, which is you get from single field inflation. So in that case, this ML, again, I have the same expressions at the top here. The scale dependence of the bispectrum, this squeeze limit, is very weak. So basically what this translates into in terms of this weighting of the background modes and how much bias comes from them is that the local power spectrum is only sensitive to this derivative of the background. So it's not sensitive to very long wavelength modes, which is sort of the intuition that you would have in just the single field inflation case anyways. So this consistency relation was mentioned earlier. And this consistency relation is basically what tells us that in the case of single field inflation, we only expect a sensitivity to modes close to the scale of the subvolume and not to arbitrarily far infrared modes. So an interesting question that you can ask here is the equilateral squeeze limit necessarily going to be protected from background modes? So as we saw, a global four-point function can affect the observed three-point function. So if for example, you have a four-point function in the larger volume with some arbitrary scale dependence, could that give you a correction to the three-point function observed in any subvolume that would change the squeeze limit behavior and increase the coupling between long and short wavelength modes? So that's something that we're kind of looking into right now, basically taking the problem that I've been outlining here and generalizing it to this case of non-local mode coupling and focusing in on the equilateral case. Last point here, tensor mode coupling. So this is basically the same question where now we're, instead of talking about the scalar curvature perturbations, we're talking about tensor modes. So I'll just go over this real quickly. If you have a three-point coupling between two tensor modes and some mode of another field, what that can do is long wavelength modes in this additional field chi, and that may be the curvature perturbations or something else, can bias the two-point function of the tensor fluctuations in any given subvolume. And so in the same way that we looked at how the three-point function can shift the spectral index of the two-point function, you can ask that same question for this kind of coupling between tensor modes and some other field. And in the same way that we found, at least statistically, it's possible to get a shift to the observed spectral index, at least statistically, it's also possible to have a coupling between tensor modes and some other field that induces a shift in the scale dependence of tensor modes in various subvolumes. So the reason this might be interesting is we're interested in the scale dependence of the tensor modes as potentially a test of inflation. So typically in models of inflation, there's a red tilt to tensor modes because the amplitude of tensor modes is just the Hubble scale during inflation, which is decreasing. So you end up with less power on shorter scales. But a question you might ask is that relationship broken if you have a coupling like this, so that if you were to observe a red tilt for tensor modes, would that necessarily be a sort of smoking gun for inflation? Or could that be induced by a coupling of this sort? So I don't know the answer to that. I guess it's at the end of the day, it's going to be a question of for what is it possible for inflation models to give you this strong of a coupling? But this is what it would look like just on statistical grounds. So here's a summary of the talk. So long local statistics can be biased by superhighs background modes. So constraints on global statistics in the case where you have such a bias are going to be probabilistic because you don't want to know what the background is. The background is drawn from some probability distribution. Local and global statistics can be qualitatively different. An example of this was we saw it's possible to have nearly Gaussian Hubble volumes in a non-Gaussian universe. And the squeezed limit behavior controls your sensitivity to infrared modes. So in the local case, you're equally sensitive to all infrared modes. In the equilateral case, for example, you're only sensitive to near infrared modes and not to arbitrarily far infrared modes. Observations can tell us if this uncertainty is relevant to our interpretation of the data. So, for example, in the case of the scale-dependent FNL, an increasing FNL on short scales can allow for a coupling between those short scales and background scales while allowing the background to still be just a perturbative fluctuation on a homogeneous background. So in that case, if you can constrain the scale dependence of FNL, you can place limits on how viable this biasing scenario would be. And the big picture idea here being that there's a link between non-Gaussianity and statistical inhomogeneity. So because if it's possible to have a coupling between long and short scales, since the long scales are inhomogeneous, varying on large scales, then the short scale statistics will be inhomogeneous as well. So the statistics themselves will vary in space with the long wavelength modes. I think the other points on this slide I mentioned earlier as well. So last thing, I'm not going to mention all of these, but future work, again, as I mentioned a moment ago, the non-local mode coupling is something we're looking into. And one other interesting thing is anomalies in the CMB from superhorizon mode coupling. So throughout the talk, we've been treating the background as a constant throughout the observable universe. If instead you have, for example, a gradient from the background, then you can have a variation of statistics across the sky from this mode coupling. And so it's interesting to look at if something like that can reproduce, for example, the power asymmetry in the CMB. And people have looked at that. So a couple other things written up here if you're some papers related to this topic if you're interested in reading more about it. But I think I will conclude there. So thank you for listening.
All right, in view of the fact that we're a little bit over and asked him tons of questions, I suggest we all go to lunch and if you have more questions, ask them there.